Hello, folks, and welcome back to our podcast on statistics for the social sciences. We are quickly wrapping up this semester and all of the different inferential statistics we need to cover in this class. And today, we're going to take yet another step forward in that with our discussion of what are known as t-tests. T-tests, the test you're going to use in SPSS to compare two different sample groups when you're trying to figure out, are they really that different from one another? So this is a very relevant and important test for many people, especially when it comes to your final research papers. Yes, I know you just did the initial draft and you're going to be working on the peer reviews this week, but I want to lay out right at the get-go that this is one you'll want to tune in for and pay attention to, as it can have a lot to do with what is expected in your final paper. All right, it's old hat by now, but please, if you haven't already, go ahead and open up the slides for t-tests. Should be around the week 12 roadmap page that you find these. And for this conversation, we're going to learn and apply the t-test, shockingly enough. But we're going to be expanding our knowledge on inferential statistics here with thinking about the difference between what are known as independent samples and dependent samples, which also ties into a very important concept when it comes to critical values, and that concept is the degrees of freedom. Okay, we're going to continue discussing how do we know whether to reject the null hypothesis, or in other words, we're going to keep practicing steps 4 and 5 of our 5 testing steps that I've listed in the slides. Again, if you look at the textbook, they're going to be using an 8-step process, but we're still looking at pretty much the tail end where we are saying, okay, how do we know whether to reject the null, aka say that something is going on here, this isn't really due to chance, or really doesn't look like that, versus when do we have to go ahead and accept that? And say, well, our groups really aren't that different, or our variables don't seem to have that much effect, so we're gonna have to accept that this is possibly due to chance. And then last but not least, I am going to do some more discussion around SPSS assignment 3. The first portion of that assignment is actually at the tail end of the slides for the one sample tests. So the first question on that assignment is a one sample testing question from around page 198 in your textbook. This week, we will be expanding on that discussion, or on that assignment, excuse me, with a few more questions regarding those independent and dependent samples and how you do that in SPSS. Before I take us down that lovely little path of learning the specifics of t-tests, I want to step back for a minute and talk about what is kind of the consistent model or the consistent formula that we're going to be encountering basically from here on out in this class to determine whether there is an effect or whether there is some sort of difference. Really, how are we knowing if what we've got here is significant, right? Going back to that question of, is this something that is different from chance? Well, last time the formula looked like what's on slide 3. We have the sample mean minus the population mean divided by the standard error of the mean. And before that, on slide 4, the standardized z-score formula, the score or value minus the mean divided by the standard deviation. These formulas, of course, look very similar, and the ones going forward will look very similar too, because in essence, the standard formula is as what appears on slide 5. With z-scores, t-tests, and next week's ANOVAs, we're looking at the size of the difference between the things that we're comparing. Whether it's two samples, a sample in a population, or more than two groups of samples, right? All of them are looking at the size of the difference between these groups or these things that we're comparing. And then we're dividing by the variance in the data, because what we're trying to figure out is the question on the right-hand side. Is the difference that we found in our study, the difference between these groups, a lot? in comparison to how much difference there is within our samples or within those groups. Remember, we're trying to think here, are these really that different? And if the thing that we're comparing to isn't very similar, or there's a lot of variation in what we're looking at, it's going to be that we have to find a really big difference to say, yes, it is truly different. There is truly an effect here, because it's going to have to be pretty extremely off of what the rest of the group looks like. Okay, I know that this is a little bit much to think about conceptually, but when we're comparing groups, we're simply looking at the difference between the groups divided by the differences within the group. And generally now is a good time, I think, to introduce kind of a visual to think about this formula. So moving to slide 7, I have pictures of two different athletic teams, a volleyball girls team and a basketball boys team. And what you can see is there's more variance in the boys team, or a bigger range in the boys team than in the girls volleyball team. Because, well, look at the tallest boy in the group versus the shortest boy in the group. And then on the left-hand side, look at the difference between the tallest girl in the group versus the shortest girl in the group. That spread between the lines is talking about how different that group is internally with respect to height. Okay, that's our measure at this point in time that we're concerned about. We're trying to think about, is the difference in height, if we were comparing two groups, really extreme compared to, well, how different is height within the group? And you can see for the volleyball team, there's just not a huge range there. There's not that much variance. There's not that much difference between the heights of the players as compared with the heights of the basketball teams. So slide 8. I've just done the picture of filling in the space between the two orange lines that mark the low and the high. And then slide 9 takes the picture of the teams away completely. So we can think more about that formula, the ratio, or the, you know, fraction, however you like to say it. The fraction would be something like the difference between the groups, as far as the highest and the lowest, divided by the difference within the groups, okay? So the difference within the volleyball team is the short height of that orange rectangle on the left. The difference within the basketball team is the tall rectangle on the right. And our fraction is taking the height of that green bar and putting that on the top of our fraction, or the top of our, you know, formula, and then dividing by the height of the orange rectangle. So when we compare this, when we think about this, if we're saying that the difference is that large green line and we're dividing by the volleyball team, where let's say the difference or the height of the green line is 10 and the variance in the volleyball team is 5, you're going to get a number 2. Okay, think of that 2 as like a Z-score, close to the tail, pretty far away from the center of our normal distribution, far away from the mean. Pretty unlikely. That's a big difference compared to how different my group is internally. But if I move to slide 11 and I look at the formula for the basketball team, well, now that difference doesn't look so big, right? Because the height of the green line is the same as the height of the orange rectangle for that group. It's 10 divided by 10, which is 1. So more like 1 standard deviation away from the mean, which is pretty average, pretty normal. Remember, that's saying, you know, that's kind of like the 70th percentile. We're getting most of our scores between 1 standard deviation below and 1 standard deviation above. So it's going to fall in that kind of normal range where we would say, not really a big difference here. So our two groups, if we're using the basketball team as our measure of variation, well, it's not that extreme. It's not a big enough difference to say this just isn't due to chance. But if we had that big a difference and we're comparing in relation to the volleyball team as far as height goes, we'd say, yeah, that's likely significant. This probably isn't due to chance. Now, my reason for elaborating all of this is because we're just seeing the difference in the formula, but the formula stays the same. So again, whether you're comparing a single value in a data set versus the mean, or you're comparing a sample mean versus the population mean, or comparing two samples, like we're going to talk about today, or even when you're comparing more than two groups. We're thinking about how different are the groups from each other versus how different are they like in and of themselves. If they're super different in and of themselves, it's going to have to be an extreme shift between the groups that we see. If you go back to my turtles, if my turtles are all right around 300 pounds, a 5-pound difference for a group might be significant. But if the weights of my turtles ranged from like 250 to 350 pounds, well, 5 pounds isn't going to make that much a difference. It's not that different in terms of the average for the group. So visually, I just wanted to walk you through what that looks like and to think about the similarities in the formula, because this really does tie together all of the tests that we do with respect to Z-scores, T-tests, or ANOVAs. We're thinking about the comparison between the groups versus the comparison within those groups. Slide 12, by the way, just takes that Z-score explanation that I gave and applies it to the basketball and volleyball team differences to show you, well, depending on what we're comparing to, makes a really big difference as far as the results we find and whether it's likely that this is due to chance or not. Overall summary, slide 13. If there's a lot of variance in our data, a wide range, we have to find a big difference for it to be significant. If there isn't a lot of variance, then we don't have to find a large difference for it to be significant. And remember, statistical significance is just, is this due to chance or not? So we're not saying anything here about effect size, whether it's a big effect or a large effect. We're simply saying, is this due to chance or is this something real that we found? And if there's a lot of variance, it's hard to find a real significant difference. Okay. More visuals of this are continued on slides 14 and 15, where I'm taking what we talked about and saying, okay, we're again looking at the differences in, let's say, the means between the groups. And when we have medium variability, versus high variability versus low variability, you can think about what the ratios are, what the fractions or the formulas look like with slide 15. We're taking that orange bar at the top and we're comparing it to the yellow line or the spread in the data at the bottom. The low variance is going to be the biggest ratio. That one probably won't be that significant, but it's going to be much more close to significant than the ratio of the difference and the high variance. With that, I'm going to stop and turn to discussion of t-tests. But if you have any questions about that or conceptually it's not making sense, do let me know. I will get back to you as soon as I can to help provide more clarification, as best I can, that is. So slide 16, and really we're halfway done already with this episode because t-tests aren't that much to explain. But when we're trying to figure out which test to use, and let's say we have two groups, well, we've already gone through one possible test, the difference between a sample or a group and a population, a one sample t-test in SPSS or a one sample z-test in your textbook. There's, by the way, a brief explanation in your textbook of why we use the t-test in SPSS because there's not a one sample z-test and there's slight differences in the assumptions about each of those, but not meaningful for this class, not important for you to know the difference. What is important to know is that if you are comparing a sample and a population, you use that one sample test. If you are comparing two different groups, two different samples, or maybe just two different groups within a single sample, and when I say two different groups, meaning there's no overlap between the groups. If you're in group A, you're not in group B. If you have that, what you are going to do is an independent samples t-test to compare truly two separate different groups. But let's say you are doing something more like you're comparing a pretest and a post-test for the same group. Maybe you did this in class in school, English or math or something, where you did a test on Monday and then they taught you the lesson and you repeated the test on Friday to see how well you did. Well, that's going to look like a paired samples t-test, also known as a dependent samples t-test. It's the same group, but we're looking at, is there a difference in the group in some way, shape, or form between two different points in time. Whether we're giving them a test or we're doing some sort of other intervention between those two points in time, we want to know, has whatever we're measuring about the group changed between time one and time two? For all of our tests, we're going to keep doing the same five steps that I've shown before, and I've repeated those here on slide 17. We will always start with a null hypothesis, then move to setting our level of significance, which for most of us should be 0.05. That's usually the standard in the social sciences. Then we'll figure out which test we need to run and run it in SPSS based on, let's say, which groups we're comparing, what types of groups we're comparing, or whether we're not looking at groups at all and we're just looking at many different variables. Let's say that might be a different type of test. But once we figure out the test, we then need to proceed to steps 4 and 5, where we have to determine what's the critical value or what's the bar we need to clear to know that what's going on here is a real effect and not due to chance. Remember, we're thinking in terms of the normal distribution. How far away from that middle of the hill do we have to be to say, ah, yes, this is past that 0.05 number, right? That 0.05 area in the normal distribution. And if I have a non-directional null hypothesis, I'm going to be splitting that significance between the two tails. So my critical value is going to be a little further out in the tails than if I do a directional null hypothesis where the full amount of the significance is in one tail or the other. But remember, that significance is not the same as the critical value. The critical value is, let's say, the Z-score that you need to get. The significance is the area in that portion of the curve, and that area is going to be starting at whatever your critical value is. If you are still finding this difficult, I'd encourage you to go back to the critical value handouts that were listed with week 10. Whether it's explaining critical values or understanding more about critical values using pictures and visuals, please take a look at those, and then again, let me know what you're running into as far as challenges with applying this concept. Step 5 is a bit more straightforward. Generally here, we're just going to be comparing our critical value and our test statistic from steps 3 and 4. And if the test statistic is more extreme than the critical value, meaning bigger than a positive critical value, if that critical value is the number 2, we'd need something bigger than the number 2. Or if it's a negative number, the test statistic is going to have to be a smaller negative number or a lower negative number. So if our critical value is negative 2, our test statistic would have to be like negative 2.5 or negative 3. Then we can reject the null hypothesis. If we're doing this in SPSS, it never lists your critical value because it's not going to look up and say, okay, given this significance level and given this type of test, here's the critical value we need to exceed. It won't list that in the results. Instead, it just lists your p-value or the chances of getting the test statistic that you got. So the final step listed on slide 17 is taking that p-value and looking at your level of significance, which you set in step 2, that 0.05, and then we decide to accept or reject the null hypothesis. If the p-value on SPSS, and by the way, that's the p-value for our test statistic, is below 0.05, 0.04, 0.01, 0.001, these are all smaller than 0.05, then we would reject our null hypothesis and say something else is going on here. This isn't due to chance. Really, what that's going to look like in a normal distribution is those values are far out in the tails, or at least further out in the tails than the cutoff for 0.05. If it's greater than 0.05 in our SPSS results, we have to accept the null hypothesis and say this could be due to chance. 0.06, you must accept the null. 0.1, accept the null. 0.2, accept the null. Okay? Anything bigger than 0.05, we accept the null and say this could be due to chance. And again, that's okay. We just want to make the right decision given the p-value that we see in SPSS and comparing it again with our level of significance, which, as I've said before, for this class, I'm just going to say 0.05. If you're not sure where to find that p-value, please go back and look at the handout from week 10 on SPSS and p-values, or SPSS significance and p-values. I can't think of the title right off the top of my head, but it's, I believe, the first handout listed below the significance testing slides. Probably significance and p-values now that I think about it. But that handout on page 2 has a bunch of SPSS results, and in the orange boxes there is where you see what the p-value is for each test and where it's presented in SPSS. It should generally be listed with a one-sided p or a two-sided p. If you're doing a one-sample test or a t-test, it may not show that when you get to an ANOVA or a regression. It may just simply show sig or p-value. Just remember, that's all the same thing. P-value, probability, the probability that this is significant, okay? Now, for all of that discussion, I'm mostly going to have you focus in the exam on doing the, let's say, interpretation of results using SPSS results. But for now, I want you to do some more practice. Practice finding that area between the mean and a specific value, let's say for a z-test. Remember what the steps are for this. We look up the area between the mean and a specific value in Appendix B, and then we add whatever half of the curve we need to add, if we need to add it. If the question asks for that, let's say for question 1 on slide 19, I would be looking at adding 50% for the second part of that, where it says, what is the likelihood of getting a score that high, where it's the area of the curve above or beyond that score. I might use the 50% to help me figure out how much is below a z-score of 2.2. But the first part of the question, the area between the mean and the curve for a z of 2.2, you're simply going to look that up in Appendix B. Remember what the steps are. We look in Appendix B, we start by looking at our z-score value, and then we move to the right to the column that says area between mean and z. And that's my answer for part 1 of the more practice on slide 19. To figure out the likelihood of getting a score that high, as in, again, area of the curve above or beyond that score, I could either add 50 to that value and then subtract it all from 100, or I could simply take 50 minus that value, because again, I'm just looking at what's left in the curve beyond that point, and I don't need to add the 50 below to figure that out. When I'm only trying to figure out the value in one half of the curve, like what question 2 on slide 19 is asking, I don't need to add anything to it. I can simply take 50 minus that value, because that's what's left in that tail above that value. So take a minute and look that up. What is the area between the mean and a z-score of 2.2? And then what's left beyond that point in the rest of that tail? And then come to slide 20, which is thinking just kind of in the reverse about using that same Appendix B. Instead of looking up a z-score, I'm going to be looking up the values in a different way, where I look more at that column of area between the mean and the z-score to figure out what my z-score will be. So question 1 on slide 20, what's the critical value for a p of less than 0.01? So I know that the area between the value and that z-score would be 90% of the curve, okay? And I'm doing a one-tailed test, so that 0.1 is in one of the tails, not both of them, all right? To figure this out, I could do the full 90%, or I could simply think about, well, half of the curve. Half of the curve is 50%. If the area below that value would be 90%, I'm going to be thinking on the positive side, because most of it's below it, right? The positive side of the normal distribution. So what's 50 minus 10? And that's the area I need to look for in Appendix B. Where do I find 0.4? And what z-score is associated with that? That z-score is my critical value. We're simply operating slightly differently. Instead of looking up the z-score and finding the significance, we're looking up the significance and finding the z-score. That's how we use significance to determine critical values if we had to do them by hand. So repeat that process with question 2 on slide 20. And instead of having it as a one-tailed test, how would it look for a two-tailed test? Okay. So now the area between the low region and the high region is 90%, but the tails, both tails, add up to 10%. And then here's the connection to the last step in our process. Let's say my actual test statistic, what SPSS calculates as a base or based on looking at my sample that I'm comparing, I get a 2.5. Is 2.5 extreme enough to reject the null hypothesis for a one-tailed test, or what you got for part 1 on slide 20? What about for question 2 on slide 20? Is 2.5 significant or extreme enough to exceed the critical value for question 2? Think through all of these steps, and as you work through each question, let me know what you come up with. Again, I want to check in and make sure that it's making sense and that you're doing the calculations in the right way and that the pieces are starting to fall in line, because it's a little bit of a conceptual jump again, but we're just reversing our process a little bit. So instead of using the Z-score column to figure out the area or the probability, we're using the probability column to figure out the Z-score. There is one other way for you to do this, and it's part of those handouts that I've developed for you. So going back again to week 10 and looking at our handouts there, if you navigate all the way back to there and you go to the section that is on the slides and handouts for this week or for this module to accompany this week's readings, if you look at the critical values handout itself, the second page actually has these standard critical values tables. They should help you. Again, if you are looking at a specific significance level, right? That's the left-hand column, let's say on page 2, if I'm looking under the section with the heading Z-score standard critical values. Let's say I have a 0.1 as my significance level, just like that question asked, and I have a one-tailed test. Well, I simply move to the column that says one-tailed test critical value, and that tells me what I need. I need a 1.28. Now, the weird symbol to the left of the 1.28 is a combination of the positive and negative, or a plus sign and a negative sign, because you could need a positive 1.28 if you're looking for the significance to all be in one side of the tail that's positive. But your critical value could also be negative if all of your significance is on the left-hand side of the normal distribution, or if we're saying that something's going to have a negative effect, right? Positive effect, it's a positive value. Negative effect, it's a negative value. And we just have to know that based on what our hypothesis, our null hypothesis, is saying. If something is not decreasing, well, we'd actually looked at the left-hand side, because we'd want to know if it did decrease, right? And if that decrease is significant, not due to chance. If it's not increasing something, we would look on the right-hand side of the normal distribution, because we'd be looking for a positive shift, right? Something more positive. And it's got to reach that cutoff point to be more positive. The table's actually a little bit easier to interpret if you're doing a two-tailed test, because it's simply telling you you need either a positive or a negative value. So in the one-tailed test critical value column, you see underneath the value positive if right-tailed test. Again, that's explaining or telling you more of what I just talked about. If it's a right-tailed test, or we're testing whether something does not increase, we'd be looking at the right-hand side of the normal distribution. But a two-tailed test says we're separating that significance out into each tail. So if I have a p-value or a significance level of 0.1 that I'm testing, choosing for my step 2, and I need to figure out the critical value with a two-tailed test, and it's a z-score, well, it's simply positive or negative 1.645. I go to the column with my significance level, and then I move to the right to my one-tailed, past my one-tailed test, to the two-tailed test. I can know my critical values simply by knowing my significance and what type of test I'm performing using this table. heck of a lot easier than looking up each independent value in Appendix B, and for the most part, these tend to be the types of things we choose. Is it 0.1, 0.05, or 0.01 for our significance? And then simply, is it a one-tailed or two-tailed test? And that's all going to be told to me by the way my null hypothesis is written. If that null hypothesis says there's no effect, and it doesn't tell me anything about increase or decrease or improve or raise or reduce, then there's no direction. Simply saying no effect, non-directional, two-tailed. If it says does not increase, does not decrease, does not improve, does not reduce, well, then that's directional. It's telling me how one is likely to affect the other. When I have a directional null, I'm using a one-tailed test. If I have a non-directional null, I'm using a two-tailed test. And that brings me back to looking at my table. Now, confusingly enough, if you look beneath the Z-score standard critical values, you're going to see t-test standard critical values, or like what we're talking about today. Now, you'll see in the description in the handout, to determine this, you first need to determine the degrees of freedom row, then significance level column, and then find the critical value in the cell where that row and column meet. We have this degrees of freedom thing we need to figure out first. Well, going back to our slides, this is really where we find a difference between a z-test and a t-test, the degrees of freedom. I've defined the concept on slide 22. It's very complex if you look at the technical definition. It's called the maximum number of logically independent values, which are values that have the freedom to vary in the data sample. So really, what this concept ties back to is how we can truly and accurately figure out the effects of any one thing on another thing. Those logically independent values are what our SPSS calculations work with to try and determine our actual test statistic. It's, again, an incredibly complex statistical theory and idea, and generally speaking, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole because, again, this is beyond what we need to cover for this class. Instead of thinking of it as that maximum number of logically independent values, okay, we're going to talk about it as the adjusted sample size. So when we have a certain sample size, we only have a limited amount of information to work with. And the smaller our sample size, the less information we have. So when we have a small sample size, we're going to make it harder and harder to reach that statistical significance because we're less and less sure of what we're looking at. We have to have something really extreme with limited information, okay? So the degrees of freedom is going to be that adjusted sample size, and really what we're hoping is that we have, you know, at least, let's say, a few in our sample size, maybe 20, maybe 30, because you can see, if you look at that handout with the t-test standard critical values, if I only have one degree of freedom, and I'm looking at a one-tailed test, to even be significant at the 0.1 level, my number has to be greater than 3.078. That's a pretty extreme value. Look at the value for 0.01. It'd have to be more extreme than 31.82. It's because we don't have much information to go on that we'd have to say, okay, it's got to be really, really extreme. Or this high bar that I have to jump over is super duper high. Because I just don't have that much information or that much confidence that what I'm finding is real here, okay? But as we get more in our sample, or as we get greater degrees of freedom, you move down that table, the numbers come down, right? From 3 to 1.8 once I have 2 degrees of freedom, to 1.638 for 3 degrees of freedom under that 0.1 level. All right, flashback to our slides. If we go to slide 23, we're just simply going to talk about how do we calculate the degrees of freedom. So calculating degrees of freedom, how do I know what to put in that DF column on the left-hand side? Well, if I have a paired samples t-test, if I'm looking at one group at two different times, then it's my sample size minus the number one. So if I had 20 people I was looking at with a pre-test and a post-test, I would subtract one to give me degrees of freedom of 19, okay? It's the same group at two different times. It's, since it's only one group, we subtract the number one, which leads me logically to say, okay, if I have two different groups and I'm doing an independent samples t-test, it's my groups added together minus two, okay? If I had two groups of 20 people, I add 20 plus 20, I subtract two, that gives me 38, like what you see on slide 24. We need to know degrees of freedom to look up critical values for t-tests. So you can either look at Appendix B, Table B2, or you can go back to that handout. And now I want you to look up what are the critical values for the questions on slide 26. If I have 2 degrees of freedom in a two-tailed test and I'm using the 0.05 significance level, okay, so I go to 2 degrees of freedom, I move to the two-tailed test section of the table on the right-hand side, and I look under the 0.05 column to get that critical value. If I have 9 degrees of freedom in a one-tailed test, this is question two on slide 26, and I use the 0.1 significance value. Okay, down the DF degrees of freedom column to 9 in my one-tailed test section, and I move to the right to the 0.1 significance level. That should be my critical value. This final question on slide 26, question three, you're going to have to actually use your book for. 27 degrees of freedom in a two-tailed test at the 0.01 significance level. That's a little more difficult to figure out because I have to look further down the table, but it's the same exact process. So get your book out or look up the electronic copy of the book and go to that Appendix B. It's Appendix B2 because we're looking at the table for t-tests. What do you get for 27 degrees of freedom under a two-tailed test at that 0.01 significance level column? And then one last note before I wrap up our conversation with discussion of effects and how to read t-tests. What do you notice about the numbers at the bottom of the two-tailed test column where it has infinity listed in the degrees of freedom? And I'm looking specifically at that handout. Right? The critical values handout. The infinity symbol is the gray row at the bottom. What do you notice about actually both the one-tailed test and the two-tailed test, the bottom values there? What do those look like that you might have seen before, perhaps in a section just above? Or perhaps if you just read that bottom portion at the bottom of page two, what does this say? Okay, y'all, we're closing in on almost 40 minutes, so it's time to wrap up this discussion with let's talk about some effect size things, remembering that significance does not cover effect size. If you remember from our discussion of the one sample tests, significance is just whether the effect is real, whether this is different from, you know, chance. But effect size is how much does this matter, right? How much is this, let's say, changing the weight of my turtles? Well, for a t-test, effect size is calculated in almost the same way as a Cohen's d. It's not the group mean minus the population mean. It's one group mean minus the other group mean divided by the standard deviation from either group, okay? If you're doing this for a paired samples t-test, it's the mean at time one minus the mean at time two divided by the standard deviation for that group, all right? Very similar to a Cohen's d. It's just a simple way of telling us how big is this effect, all right? Slide 29, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about effect size for t-tests, but it is important for you to be able to read these results because they're presented in a certain way. Like the language of t-tests, the written language, is a little odd. So I've given you two examples on slide 29 here to say, okay, if there's a t with a 24 in parentheses, that subscript next to it, an equal sign of then a 2.38 comma p less than 0.05, right? The alligator always eats the bigger number with that p value. That's at least how I was taught. The way you'd read that, the t-test value is 2.38 with 24 degrees of freedom. The probability of getting this value if the null hypothesis is true is less than 5%, or the probability of getting this value, if this was due to chance, is less than 5%. The second one reads as the t-test value is 1.24 with 10 degrees of freedom. Remembering the degrees of freedom here are always those values in the parentheses that appear next to the t and their subscript. They're kind of below where the t is. The probability of getting this value if the null hypothesis is true is greater than 10%. That's where the p is the larger value being eaten by the alligator, and the 0.1 is on the right-hand side. So the p is bigger than 0.01. Excuse me, 0.1. Apologies. That can be very confusing the way I just said that. Probability is greater than 10%. This could be due to chance. And with that, my friends, we are done covering the main material. What I'm going to encourage you to do right now, go back to the week 12 roadmap page. There is a worksheet on there for a calculation of z-scores and t-tests. Really, just a chance to practice this in a more applied fashion. Now, that practice worksheet is actually going to have answers available to you by Thursday, not Friday, as the slides say. I want you to take some time to work through it to see how you're doing with application of the ideas and the formulas. Again, it's not usually a lot in terms of math. It's more about putting it all together in your mind and seeing how it works and how it fits. And if you're finding that that's a very difficult process, I'd encourage you to reach out and set up a time to chat with me about that. So maybe we can come up with a game plan for how to make this work easier for you. And then, of course, we also have SPSS Assignment 3. So that is going to have two particular questions related to t-tests on it, question 2 and question 3, which confusingly are going to be listed as Chapter 11, question 6, and Chapter 12, question 5. Now that's actually where you find those questions. I've got the page numbers listed and everything in SPSS Assignment 3, but again, it's the second thing you'll do and the third thing you'll do for SPSS Assignment 3. If walking through that gets you all wonky, let me know. But we've already covered what would be the first question from Chapter 10, question 8. That's the one sample test process, so make sure you use that in SPSS to answer that question. And then describe or list out in your response all of the sub-questions I've asked, the t-value from that test, the p-value, and how would you explain what that p-value means, and then putting your SPSS output into the actual, you know, document that you submit for this assignment. And then, of course, talk about whether the month in 2016 was significantly different from the months in 2015 for that first question. For questions 2 and 3 on t-tests, make sure you address all of the bulleted points underneath the question, okay? That's really going to be something I look for, which is going to be both your SPSS output, blah, boy, long pod, been one for today. Put in that output and then address all of the bulleted points. That is how you will earn full points on this assignment, okay? And if you want to double check, take a look at the rubric at the bottom. You can preview the rubric just to see exactly how many points go with each portion of each question. All right, tongue-twisting time aside, it is time for me to sign off for today and wish you the best with doing this work. As always, you can always, always email me. Let me know what questions you have, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. Please, once you are done with chapters 11 and 12, because that's the dependent samples and the independent samples t-test chapters, move on to chapters 13 and 14 for analysis of variance, or how we compare more than two groups. I wish you all a great day, week, weekend, wherever you're at. And I look forward to speaking with you again with, let's hope, better ability to talk through a podcast episode very soon.